that life. There are difficulties, though. To get this life is also difficult. So I am constantly struggling if I should accept this hardship in the worldly life or I should tolerate all the suffering to get to that eternal life. A wise person will accept the latter, that hardship. God tells us in the Quran that He tests with difficulties. Be patient, He tells us. He urges us to tolerate limited difficulties which shall pass. I am not sure if I finally get to a worldly conclusion. So which path should I take? The Imam told Sa'd, "You imagine you would get the wheat in Ray by securing the leadership to that territory? You are not going to get that," he said. But he did not believe Imam Hussein. He made fun of him. "Even the barley would be enough," he said. He could acquire neither the barley nor the wheat. He was defeated where he was taking orders from his commander. They told him that they did not guarantee anything. This is the life on earth. I just need one signature to be dismissed from any post I got. That you lost that possession. That you lost your wife. Those oppressive leaders would like that. Oppressive leaders did not even have mercy on a man's wife. But those who were after dignity, they were taken captive anyway. But they posed a challenge to the regime. When they arrived in Kufa, Her Excellency Zainab bint Ali and Umm Kulthum and His Excellency Zainal Abidin, who was in chain, started a revolution in Kufa. But they did not care about their disloyalty, and so on and so forth, until their leader, evil Yazid. They suffered those difficulties. And you tell me who was the winner. After 14 centuries, many struggled to put out this light. The one who tolerated that pain, but his course survived. It's Imam's course that makes that Indian go into that fire. With the faith he has in Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, he survives the fire. He calls Hussein's name. This is what we need to believe in. We, believers who are proud of this person, should not be deceived by the material world. There are difficulties we need to fight, yes, but we have to let go of corporal desires and take the path of our Imam.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. The limelight.
Even as the Zionist regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is recovering from his surgery, protests rage on with demonstrators lining up in front of the Knesset building in the occupied Al-Quds. Tensity has come up in the area around the Knesset as legislators begin the debate on the so-called judicial plan. Irrespective of the vote and the outcome of the plan, the Zionist regime has reached a dead end. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more.
Thank you.
Press TV noted, in a tweet laced with sharp wit and profound wisdom, Iran's foreign ministry spokesperson Nasser Kanani has recently linked the simmering crisis gripping the Israeli regime with the health condition of the regime premier. Kanani wrote, there are reports that doctors have implanted a pacemaker in the heart of the prime minister of the Zionist regime, referring to Benjamin Netanyahu's dramatic health scare and surgery. He hastened to add, but it is clear that the crisis at the heart of the Zionist regime is deeper than the crisis in the heart of its prime minister, pointing to the gravity and magnitude of the crisis. The emergency heart procedure came as month-long protests against the crisis-stricken regime in Tel Aviv reached a fever pitch, with hundreds of thousands pouring into the streets and seeking answers. As irate protesters upped the ante, seizing the airport and blocking major highways, Netanyahu's health deteriorated dramatically, and he had to be admitted to a hospital for heart pacemaker implantation, adding a new dizzying twist to the fate of the regime's uncertain future. The ailing premier clearly didn't see it coming and perhaps thought the illegitimate apartheid child-murdering regime was invincible. He thought he could crush the anti-regime rebellion the way he and his predecessors have been trying to crush Palestinians for decades, albeit without much luck. Let's get this straight. The so-called plan to overhaul the judicial system is not the main issue here. These protesters are in the streets because the illegitimate regime has been unable to gain legitimacy, both inside and outside, and they do not feel safe or secure in the occupied territories anymore. They are protesting because Netanyahu and his predecessors have failed them. They were promised safe sanctuary by the Zionist leaders, but the regime is already facing an existential crisis, teetering on the verge of collapse and extinction amid the all-encompassing rise of the Palestinian resistance. They are angry because the young and extraordinarily brave generation of Palestinians has taken up the cudgels and vowed to reclaim their occupied land, the stolen orchards and the deserted homes. The men and women protesting in Tel Aviv clearly do not expect the regime to come to their rescue. Netanyahu loves hollow rhetoric, threatening the Islamic Republic of Iran and the resistance axis, but deep down he is a chicken-hearted ruler who feels intimidated by the sight of protesters and cannot muster the courage to face them. He knows what they want, his unconditional immediate ouster. But that's not all. Protesters want Netanyahu and his minions to come clear on the fate of the regime and where it is headed, clearly in the dustbin of history. That's not something Netanyahu or his far-right ministers like to admit. The Zionist regime leaders have so far lived in denial about the existential crisis, about the fact that the Palestinian resistance has grown by leaps and bounds and is prepared to liberate the occupied lands. It has been on full display in recent months in the Gaza Strip and in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin, with the occupying forces and illegal settlers getting a harsh reality check. And these people, who refuse to leave the streets now, have all these years been fed lies about the regime's invincibility. That balloon has burst now, giving heartache to Netanyahu. Even polls have not been in Netanyahu's favor, compounding his worries. A Channel 13 poll in April showed his Likud party garnering only 20 Knesset seats, compared to 32 in November if elections. The embattled premier had gone to the Sea of Galilee recently to escape the scorching summer heat and the fury of anti-regime protesters, but he couldn't escape the anxiety and fear residing in his heart. Some Israelis have unsurprisingly taken to Twitter in recent days, questioning lies about his health, which they claim are only the latest in a lifelong string of falsehoods, incitement and manipulations. Even Haaretz reported that Netanyahu's doctors admitted his cardiac arrhythmia had already been detected last week, rebuffing an initial statement that no irregular heartbeat was detected.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Niger and yet another coup across the African continent. It was on Wednesday when the coup, headed by the country's presidential guard, began unfolding. Soldiers belonging to the guards detained President Mohamed Bazoum and blocked access to his residence in the capital, Niamey. The president's office initially said the guards were unsuccessful in getting support from the National Armed Forces. But shortly after, the army, led by General Abdelrahman Tiani, expressed support for the coup and said its priority was to avoid destabilizing the country. The military takeover was met with mixed reactions inside of Niger, with the African nation turning into scenes of utter chaos. Bazoum's supporters held a protest rally outside the National Assembly in Niamey, calling for his release. But pro-coup protesters who saw things differently set fire to ruling party headquarters in the capital. They burned French flags and stoned its mission, echoing a growing wave of resentment towards former colonial power France and its influence in the Sahel region. Images showed fires at the embassy wall and people being loaded into ambulances with injuries. The ralliers raised Russian flags and called for the departure of foreign forces. Apart from internal reactions to the coup in Niger, the military takeover in the West African nation has also had international implications. The African Union demanded Nigerian military restore constitutional authority within 15 days. It also demanded the release of President Bazoum and his family.
I join with the African Union and the communique it issued to strongly condemn the events in Niger, recommend the re-establishing of the constitutional order, and demand the immediate release of President Bazoum and his family.
The Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, also called for the constitutional order to be restored. The Union imposed sanctions and threatened force if Niger's coup leaders failed to reinstate ousted President Bazoum within a week. ECOWAS and the 8-member West African Economic and Monetary Union said borders with Niger would be closed, commercial flights banned, financial transactions halted, and aid ended with immediate effect. The United Nations condemned the coup and called for the release of President Bazoum.
And that is the reason why I made today a very strong appeal, not only for him to be immediately released, but not only that, for the democratic institutions to be reestablished.
The European Union suspended its financial support for Niger following the overthrow of the president there. EU Foreign Policy Chief Joseph Borrell said in addition to the immediate cessation of budget support, all cooperation actions in the field of security will also be suspended indefinitely. France took a similar move, saying Paris suspended all development aid and budget support to Niger with immediate effect. The United States has also threatened to take similar action. Many have warned that the military coup in Niger will have severe consequences, not only for Africa, but for other continents like Europe.
We're talking about the last country that remains a place where both humanitarians and security experts have access to kind of manage the flow of migrants into Europe and provide humanitarian assistance and access to these vulnerable communities. So it creates an entire vacuum where people can now more freely move, but also you're going to see a lot more nefarious actors cross that desert passage and make their way up to Europe.
But apart from humanitarian implications, the coup in Niger will ultimately bring, putting pieces of the puzzle together, what seems to be of high significance is the growing anti-French sentiment in Africa and particularly across the Sahel region. Taking the Sahel region's 7 coups of recent years into account, with the most recent ones in Mali and Burkina Faso, it seems that people have long been tired of the French political dominance in the area and are gradually turning toward countries like Russia and China for that matter. But most importantly, what seems to be of high urgency for France and countries alike is to stop interfering in the internal affairs of Niger and let its people decide their own fate. African leaders have once again traveled to Russia in an effort to discuss solutions to the war in Ukraine and subsequently bring an end to a grain crisis already threatening the continent. Addressing the summit were representatives from 49 of Africa's 54 nations, including 17 heads of state and 4 heads of government in attendance. Putin said Russia was ready to replace Ukraine's grain export to Africa on both a commercial and aid basis to fulfill Moscow's critical role in global food security. Putin said Moscow will be ready to provide Burkina Faso, Zimbabwe, Mali, Somalia, Central African Republic, and Eritrea with 25 to 50,000 tons of free grain each in the next 3 to 4 months. Putin also hit back at countries critical of Moscow's decision to quit the Black Sea grain deal, saying a parallel memorandum promising to facilitate Russian grain and fertilizer exports had been ignored. Putin noted that over 70% of Ukrainian grain exported under the deal had gone to countries with above-average income. The Russian president said poorest countries like Sudan had been, quote, screwed over and received less than 3% of the shipments. Putin criticized Western sanctions imposed on Moscow in response to the war in Ukraine, saying on the one hand, Western countries are obstructing supplies of our grain and fertilizers, while on the other, they hypocritically blame us for the current crisis situation on the world food market. Moscow argues that restrictions on payments, logistics, and insurance are a barrier to shipments. The summit in St. Petersburg comes a month after African leaders presented their peace initiative to both Putin and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, but it has so far failed to gain traction with either side. Moscow said it respected their peace proposal on Ukraine and was carefully studying it. But apart from grain, the St. Petersburg summit also focused on opposition to neocolonialism. Addressing the summit, President Putin said,
pointed out our joint determination to oppose neocolonialism, illegal sanctions, and attempts to undermine traditional moral values. We confirmed our determination to hold summits once in 3 years.
The Russian president reiterated that the summit was seeking a multipolar world order based on international law and mutual respect.
The result of our work is a solid pack of documents. Firstly, I will point out the St. Petersburg Declaration. It talks about a strategic long-term partnership between Russia and African countries. It also talks about the dedication of all our countries to forming a just and multipolar world order based on universally recognized principles of international law and the UN Charter.
Putin further noted that the BRICS countries, namely Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, are taking measures to develop their economic trade relations in their own currencies in an effort to ditch the US dollar.
Our BRICS countries are developing relations in national currencies and settlements are increasing. In this regard, it seems to me that the bank can also play an important role in the development of our joint activities.
He hailed BRICS for developing their trade relations while also taking a jab at the United States for using the dollar as a political tool against other nations.
What is happening in the world of finances and the use of dollar is an instrument of political struggle. But the members of our organization, the BRICS, are not friends against anyone. They're working in each other's interests.
The comments by the Russian president from one side and the St. Petersburg summit attended by the African leaders from the other are clear indications of a shift toward a multipolar world. African nations have been distancing themselves from the West and moving closer to Moscow for help amid coups and other instabilities across their continent. The war in Ukraine has played the role of a catalyst in this regard. From the global dominance of the US dollar to supply chains and international alliances, everything is in the direction of a multipolar world. Washington unilateral sanctions on Russia, Iran, and China, and many other countries have prompted these nations to form new alliances with the aim of creating alternative payment and financial systems outside US control. With market chains raising prices in a number of countries like Germany from one hand and looming global food shortages on the other, it seems that the need for countries like Russia, China, India, Brazil, and Iran to form their alliance in the face of US unilateralism is gaining momentum. Maybe that's why the Russian president talks of a bright future in the emerging multipolar world.
England is facing a homelessness crisis. According to the latest official figures, the number of people living in temporary accommodation in England has hit a 25-year high. Over 104,000 households were in temporary accommodation by the end of March of this year, the highest figure since records began in 1998. The figure shows a 10% jump of homeless people in England compared to last year. 9,520 more households have been placed in temporary accommodation since 2022.
Catherine West.
Thank you very much, Madam Deputy Speaker. Could we have a debate in government time on a very sad record which will be broken? The highest ever number of families in homeless households in temporary accommodation in London by the end of this summer. Ever. The long-term impacts on health and educational attainment of our citizens is at risk. Would she agree with me that in the current climate, with the mortgage crisis, the unaffordable rents going up by 20% in some London boroughs, and very, very long queues for social homes because of the lack of money from the government to build them, we do desperately need to tackle the housing crisis in London and beyond.
Over 131,000 children are also in temporary accommodation, the highest figure on record. Almost 14,000 households were in hotels or bed and breakfast in the 3 months to March. Figures also show a sharp rise in homelessness in older people in the year to the 31st of March, with a 33.3% increase in the number of homeless households with a priority need due to old age. Experts say loss of a private tenancy is the leading cause of homelessness. Instability in the private rental market, exacerbated in the short term by rising interest rates and mortgage payment increases, has led to steep rent rises and property owners deciding to sell their properties. Campaigners say a lack of housing, exacerbated by a decision by ministers to freeze local housing allowance rates for the past 3 years, also lies at the root of the problem. The number of households being issued with no-fault evictions has also risen in the past year, with a 21% increase in those at risk of homelessness due to a no-fault eviction. The government has also frozen the local housing allowance at 2020 levels. First, the amount which people claiming household benefits who rent privately are entitled.
Let's test that, because the question he refuses to answer, he actually knows the answer to this question, is £2,900 extra. That's the cost to the average family of the Tory mortgage penalty. Now, he was warned by experts about this as long ago as autumn last year, but he either didn't get it, didn't believe it, or didn't care, because he certainly didn't do anything. And when I raised this a couple of months ago, he had the gall to stand at that dispatch box and say he was delivering for homeowners. How is an extra £2,900 a year on repayment delivering for homeowners?
The homelessness crisis in England comes at the heels of a mortgage crisis, which has been brewing for some time. Back in June, the Bank of England hiked interest rates by 50 basis points to 5%. The move has affected millions of homeowners, as the interest rates on many mortgages are directly linked to the central bank's base rate. Renters have seen their payments increase, as buy-to-let landlords pass on higher mortgage repayments. Estimates show interest rate hike would see 1.2 million UK households run out of savings by the end of the year because of higher mortgage repayments. Higher borrowing costs are not just affecting households with mortgages and other loans, but forcing companies to tread more carefully in their management of costs in a tougher economy. The mortgage crisis comes against the backdrop of a slowdown in the economy.
If you push interest rates too high, you may be able to bring inflation down, but you will certainly push the economy into recession, and you will cause problems with the mortgage markets.
The inflation in June stood at 7.9%, a little bit lower than 8.2% in May, but still well above the Bank of England's 2% target. But at the same time, economic output fell 0.1% in May from April. All sectors of the economy contracted, with the exception of services. There are now fears of a possible recession due to the inflation and rising interest rates.
I am really worried about this. I am very, very worried about this. I think the word stagflation, stag being the recession side of growth, inflation being high price inflation, is going to be something that you and me and others will say way too many times in the next few months.
Devastating wildfires have gripped south of the Mediterranean region and North Africa amid soaring temperatures and an unprecedented heat wave. Thousands of tourists and residents have been forced to flee a popular Greek vacation island, Rhodes, due to devastating wildfires that have been burning for days. As the fires continue to spread across the island, approximately 19,000 people have been forced to evacuate, including both tourists and residents. The scale of the evacuation is unprecedented, making it the largest ever in Greece's history. However, Greece is not the only country to have been affected by the crisis. Blazes have also spread to parts of Croatia, Portugal, Italy and Turkey and Spain. Algeria has also recorded scores of blazes over 16 provinces, all made more extreme by fierce winds and continued extreme heat. Wildfires spreading through Algeria have left dozens of people dead and forced the evacuation of hundreds of people from their homes. Fires in pine forests in Tunisia, near its border with Algeria, have forced scores of people to be evacuated by sea and by land, with temperatures nearing 50 degrees Celsius. Wildfires also broke out in the woodlands of Latakia, a governorate on the Mediterranean, in northwestern Syria. Record-breaking temperatures across Europe and North Africa have left the land dry and susceptible to wildfires. Almost half of the EU is said to be at risk of severe drought. It's now widely believed that European and North African temperatures would have been virtually impossible without the effects of climate change.
The situation that we see in southern Europe shows that we are in the climate crisis. It's already here. It is not unexpected. The scientists have been telling us about this.
In terms of heat waves, more often we see that every study that we do, we see the fingerprint of climate change in intensifying this type of events of heat waves. So it's pretty clear, it's unequivocal that human-induced climate change is influencing heat wave events in terms of intensity and the frequency of occurrence.
The unprecedented heat waves and rising temperatures have once again raised calls for a collective action to tackle the crisis. Petteri Talas, who heads the World Meteorological Organization, has said the reduction of fossil fuel consumption is the key to reverse the negative trend in climate change and mitigate weather extremes such as heat waves, floods and droughts.
Key issue for the welfare of mankind and biosphere and for the coming generations and also for the global economy is that we have to reduce our consumption of fossil fuels, which is the main reason for these heat waves, flooding events, droughts and more intense tropical storms and also melting of glaciers worldwide.
He noted that even though actions were being taken to strengthen the response to the threat of climate change and develop more clean energy sources such as wind, solar and nuclear power, they were not happening fast enough. Experts warn that there is no immediate respite in sight from this summer of extremes. The UN Meteorological Organization said that high temperatures around the world could continue into August. The start of the El Niño weather phenomenon in June is only expected to amplify the frequency and intensity of these extreme events. The global weather phenomenon refers to when waters in the Pacific Ocean become much warmer than usual. Studies have shown the connection between rapid warming and changes to essential weather patterns. These climate extremes also mean stronger storms, more intense droughts and heat waves. Earlier in July, UN Chief Antonio Guterres warned that climate change is out of control.
We are hurtling towards disaster, eyes wide open, with far too many willing it all on wishful thinking and proven technologies and silver bullet solutions. It's time to wake up and step up.
More frequent and more intense heat waves are disrupting life around the world and causing life-threatening temperatures. Places that are sweltering under dangerous heat include China, India, Central America and the West Asia region. The United States has been the world's biggest polluter since the Industrial Revolution, emitting significant greenhouse gases, particularly carbon dioxide. In 2022 alone, the U.S. was responsible for 13% of the global CO2 discharge, emitting around 5 billion metric tons of CO2 into the global atmosphere.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
IRIB English Radio.
The US and the EU can't countenance an international order that they don't lead, while Russia and China are striving to build a fair and just order where all countries are equal regardless of their size. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Global Times wrote in this regard, St. Petersburg hosted the second Russia-Africa summit from July 27th to 28th that was attended by 17 heads of state from that continent. They and other participants, which also included 5 vice presidents and 4 heads of government alongside many national delegations, bravely defied Western pressure to come to this event. Russian officials earlier claimed that the US and the EU were trying to talk their guests out of going. This allegation was lent credence by the publication of hostile Western media editorials. The overwhelming majority of African countries participated in some capacity after only 5 countries declined to send representatives to the summit. Western political and media pressure failed to ruin the event because African countries appreciate the ways in which Russia can help them strengthen their sovereignty during these unpredictable times. The West anti-Russian sanctions that were imposed after the start of its special operation in Ukraine caused problems for its African partners, which weren't resolved in spite of the Black Sea Grain Initiative that Moscow recently declined to extend after it accused the West of not fulfilling its part of the deal. Nevertheless, Russian President Vladimir Putin promised during the latest summit to ship the neediest of them grain free of charge by year's end. This brings the analysis around to discussing other aspects of the event, since it concerned more than just strengthening Russian-African agricultural cooperation. Consistent with the theme of peace, security, and development, military ties were discussed bilaterally with interested countries behind closed doors, but the details weren't publicly disclosed due to their sensitivity. Additionally, academic, energy, financial, industrial, institutional, media, and other forms of cooperation were also discussed. What connects everything together is that the comprehensive expansion of Russian-African relations in each of these spheres advances President Putin's vision of helping his country's partners on the continent strengthen national and cultural sovereignty, like he pledged to do leading up to the summit. He has regularly spoken about this concept since the start of the special operation, which he considers to be the prerequisite for mutually beneficial partnerships. It deserves to be mentioned at this point that not a single African country jumped on the West anti-Russian sanctions bandwagon despite immense pressure to do so. This includes those who voted against it at least once at the UNGA. Never before had all of Africa come together like this. Its countries clearly wanted to show the international community that they are truly independent and will no longer let their former colonizers dictate their policies. The West was shocked by this unprecedented display of sovereignty, which is why its officials and media began waging an information warfare campaign against Russia in a desperate attempt to convince African countries to sanction it. Examples include false claims that its military advisors are responsible for atrocities and lying that Russia is weaponizing famine in Africa. No African country was swayed into sanctioning Russia, however, not even those that didn't attend the latest summit. They all know that their objective national interests are best served by keeping their strategic options open and not burning bridges with any of their partners, no matter the external pressure put upon them. Russia is regarded as a historically reliable partner with whom ties can be expanded in whatever sphere any given African country wants, which can help diversify from their previously disproportionate dependence on the West, while complementing their efforts to cultivate even closer ties with China. Russia doesn't attach strings to its agricultural and military aid, nor does China attach any to its infrastructure investments and market access, with these forms of cooperation combining to strengthen African state sovereignty. Moreover, these major countries are also sincere in their desire to improve people-to-people ties, especially academic exchanges and skills training. The reason for this is that they envisage Africa as a whole functioning as an independent pole in the emerging multipolar world order. Therein lies the primary difference between the US and the EU on one hand and Russia and China on the other. The first pair attaches strings of some sort of all forms of aid in order to keep Africa subordinated to them, while the second pair never attaches any of the aforesaid since it wants to empower Africa's rise. This insight enables one to better understand the significance of the second Russia-Africa summit, which is intended to function as Russia's complementary version of the Forum on China-Africa Cooperation. Both events take place at multi-year intervals, thus providing enough time to make progress on their action plans. Although Russia is comparatively late in re-engaging with Africa, it more than makes up for this delay with the strategic role that it plays in ensuring its partners' agricultural and military needs.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترك همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The viewpoints of the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, about Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and the tragedy of Karbala. Blood gained a victory over the sword on the day of Ashura, and Zainab al-Kubra was the cause of that victory. It was not the case that she had an audience sitting in front of her and listening in silence. She was not speaking the way an orator would speak to his audience. She was surrounded by the enemies, holding spears in their hands. There were also some ordinary people there, the same people who gave up Muslim to Ibn Ziyad, the same people who wrote letters to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and there broke their allegiance to him, the same people who hid in their homes exactly when they were supposed to stand up to Ibn Ziyad. Among the people, there were also some individuals who were not courageous enough to do what they should have done, and they were watching Imam Ali's daughter in tears on that day.
Ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum. أنا لاتشان.
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
أنا لاتشان. أنا لات.
Zainab al-Kubra was faced with this motley and unreliable crowd. Yet she spoke in a firm manner. She was an exemplary woman in history. Such women cannot be considered weak. This faithful feminine nature may reveal itself in difficult conditions. She is a role model for all great men and women in the world. She presented a deep analysis of the problems facing the revolution started by the Holy Prophet of Islam and Imam Ali alayhi salam. She said, "You could not distinguish between right and wrong in the fitna. You were unable to fulfill your duty. As a result, they severed the head of the Holy Prophet's grandson and put it on a spear." We can understand the greatness of her character when we consider such things. Zainab al-Kubra salamullah alayha played an unparalleled role on the way of Karbala with Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam on the day of Ashura with all those hardships and after Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam had been martyred. It is impossible to find a similar figure in history. Later on, numerous events took place during her captivity in Kufa and in Sham. Because of these great selfless efforts, Zainab al-Kubra gained a prominent position before Allah the Exalted. And this is something that we cannot describe.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime occupation authorities have recently forced a Palestinian owner to self-demolish his own house in occupied Al-Quds neighborhood of Beit Hanina, citing unpermitted construction as a pretext. Witnesses said that Ahmad Saud, the owner, demolished his own house after being pressed into doing so by all Israeli municipality. Saud had no choice but to do so in order to avoid paying exorbitant fees to the Israeli regime municipality in the event that its crews carried out the demolition on their own. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, the Saud family, with the help of neighbors, demolished their own home in the Al-Quds neighborhood of Beit Hanina. But why? The Zionist regime occupation authorities forced the Palestinian family to self-demolish their own house in occupied Al-Quds neighborhood of Beit Hanina, citing unpermitted construction as a pretext. Witnesses told the official Palestinian news agency Wafa that Ahmad Saud, the owner, demolished his own house after being pressed into doing so by all Israeli municipality. Saud had no choice but to do so in order to avoid paying exorbitant fees to the Zionist regime municipality in the event that its crews carried out the demolition on their own. Either way, the house would have to be demolished. Palestinian families sometimes opt to self-demolish to avoid the high cost of having their own homes destroyed by the Zionist regime military. Under the pretext of building without a permit, which is almost never granted to Palestinians in the occupied city, the Zionist regime municipality has been demolishing or forcing Palestinians to demolish their homes in Al-Quds as part of a policy aimed to restrict Palestinian expansion in occupied Al-Quds. At the same time, the municipality and government facilitate the construction of tens of thousands of housing units in illegal settlements in East Al-Quds for Zionist settlers, with the goal of offsetting the demographic balance in favor of the Jewish settlers in the occupied city. Although Palestinians in East Al-Quds, a part of internationally recognized Palestinian territory that has been subject to Israeli regime military occupation since 1967, they are denied their citizenship rights and are instead classified only as residents whose permits can be revoked if they move away from the city for more than a few years. They are also discriminated against in all aspects of life, including housing, employment, and services, and are unable to access services in the West Bank due to the construction of the Zionist regime separation wall. According to Tasnim News Agency, the Zionist regime demolished 54 Palestinian-owned structures in East Al-Quds in the largest division of the occupied West Bank in July, according to the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. It said a total of 66 Palestinians, including 34 children, were displaced as a result of the demolitions that took place between July 5th and 24th, and the livelihoods of more than 795 others were affected. The UN body said in its report that 16 of the affected structures were provided by donors, of which 15 were demolished in a single incident in Al-Muntar area of Al-Quds, while the sole remaining structure was destroyed in Beit Jala town. The report highlighted that 80% of the affected structures were in Area C of the West Bank, which constitutes about 61% of the territory and is under full Israeli regime military control. The other 11 structures were demolished in East Al-Quds, including 9 residential structures, resulting in the displacement of 5 households, comprising 24 people, including 12 children. 8 of the 11 structures demolished in that area were destroyed by their own owners to avoid payment of fines to the Zionist regime authorities. Additionally, the Zionist regime authorities demolished 2 agricultural-related structures in Birin district of the West Bank under the false pretext of trespassing a land owned by the Zionist regime. The OCHA report said Israeli regime forces, in addition to demolitions, evictions and forcible displacement, shot and killed 10 Palestinians, among them children, between July 4th and 27th, during separate raids in Nablus, Qalqilia and Ramallah. Furthermore, the UN body said 352 Palestinians, including at least 56 children, were injured by Israeli regime forces across the West Bank during the mentioned period. At least 26 of the miners were struck by live ammunition. The Zionist regime routinely demolishes Palestinian houses in the occupied West Bank and East Al-Quds, claiming that the structures have been built without permits, which are almost impossible to obtain. They also sometimes order Palestinian owners to demolish their own houses or pay the cost of the demolition. The fabricated regime of Israel has already occupied thousands of dunams of Palestinian agricultural lands to construct and expand new illegal settler units in various areas in the West Bank. More than 600,000 Israelis live in over 230 settlements built since 1967 Israeli regime occupation of the Palestinian territories of the West Bank and Al-Quds. All Israeli settlements are illegal under international law. The United Nations Security Council has condemned the Zionist regime's settlement activities in the occupied territories in several resolutions. Palestinians want the West Bank as part of a future independent state, with East Al-Quds as its capital.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The Arab woman who took on two far-right activists in a bid to save a Quran from desecration in Denmark has been identified. Iraqi-Danish citizen Quds al-Samarai risked her own life while en route to visit a friend on Monday, the 24th of July. The footage of the incident, which occurred outside Iraq's embassy, went viral on social media. The video clearly shows Quds grabbing the Quran before being wrestled to the ground by the two men. In one instance, one of the desecrators can be seen with his hands reaching for her neck. Police later arrested Quds on accusations